as we wait to see if this is actually going to work or not, as we just get going. So, in the last class, we were talking about Harris's theories about how peer groups are more significant in terms of development than family groups, parents, across generations. And we finished up by looking at some of her attempts to integrate her theory into an evolutionary psychology perspective and discussed how there's some underlying flaws in her application of evolutionary theory. A lot of you have got notes already, so you can sort of follow along here as we see if this hopefully works or not. But with respect to, more broadly, evaluating this idea of parents have little social influence on children, look, even if we look at traditional developmental psychology, this doesn't agree with Harris's interpretation. There are numerous studies over 90 years that show that early childhood experiences due to exposure from family members, raising style, interaction with parents and caregivers are extremely significant. We talk about attachment theory. Belsky's attachment theory is predicated on the idea of interaction between across generations here. So suggesting that this is being provided strictly by peers is not in agreement with your basic psychological research and theory. If we look at things like, for example, verbal behavior, we know the best predictor of a child's verbal abilities are the degree to which parents will talk to and or read to a child. So there are some issues. Now, I mean, that being said, we do have the behavioral genetics material coming out of identical twins, reared together and apart, and you know these issues with respect to unique environmental effects. But still, at present, there seems to be some issues with Harris's interpretation here. We might say that I had a feeling that this projector is dead. Yeah, it's not even lighting up. Okay, well, we'll just get to do it the old-fashioned way, what a lecture used to mean, which is me lecturing. Okay. So in terms of looking at peers here, Harris's theory is probably what we should call, at least with respect to evolutionary psychology, a just-so story. The kind of thing that Stephen Jay Gould complained about, in fact, is that it could be true, but just like Kipling's stories about how the elephant got its trunk, which was having its short nose pulled on by a crocodile, it's not necessarily true. It's possible that we've got different attitudes in children, siblings within the family. This could be due to the children joining two different peer groups. Sure. But why did they join different peer groups? So, I mean, you might say take a step back and go, well, okay, then what motivated that? Is it a genetic issue? Or is it something about the family dynamic that pushes the children in the same family, perhaps in different directions? Pinker argues that these could be just a lot of very chance factors. The availability of placement in a particular school for one child or the other, seeing something about a particular musical instrument puts one child into one band program, another into some other activity. Vandel argues that it could actually be due to these interactions between the parent's behavior and child personality. So Vandel's arguing that parental behavior serves as the most significant environment for young children in particular, and so the young child's genetics, as we talked about frequently, genes are going to interact with environment, but from the point of view of a young child, I mean, the overall environment of Alberta or whatnot is pretty insignificant in many respects to your average one-year-old, two-year-old, right? They don't go wandering out about the environment by themselves, so what's perhaps most significant, Vandel argues, is the environment in which the parents are, if you will, filters in terms of what sort of environmental parameters are there. The parent and the parenting behaviors themselves actually become the most significant aspects of the child's environment. And so a child's underlying genetics, then these genetic predispositions that will interact with the environment, well, what they're mostly interacting with, at least for the first few years of life, is going to be that parent-based environment. And those can be very significant in terms of future development. Belsky, again, going back to attachment theory, 2005, Belsky suggested that children are going to be differentially susceptible to parental influence. Now, again, some of this is going to be due to underlying genetic predispositions. Some of it will be due to, sort of individual predispositions, but Belsky's also arguing that some of this is going to be a very long-term evolved adaptation. So he says this ability to respond differently, to be susceptible to different things. In other words, not to have every child develop exactly the same way. He says this is going to be an adaptation. He says this is going to depend upon the environmental parameters that children encounter. And again, this goes back to our discussion of childhood serving as a predictor for future environments. So if you've got a stable environment then, if you are in a stable environment, Belsky argues, it would make sense for children to imitate parental behavior. So we've got a case where times are good. Well, if times are good, that's perhaps in part because your parents are doing whatever it is to help make the times good. If it's working for your parents, why not do it too? So this observational learning becomes very significant. On the other hand, if you've got an unstable environment, what worked for your parents' generation might not apply to your generation. If the environment is unstable, then looking at it from this perspective, the environment's unstable, clearly your parents aren't getting it right. There's something lacking in your parents' behavioral repertoire such that they cannot take and produce stability within the child's environment. Well, if it's unstable, then don't do that. It's not working. Try something else. Perhaps looking to peers, then, might be a way to go. So looking at this, as I said as well about Harris, Harris is taking a lot of her material from post-World War II Britain. And post-World War II Britain and Europe as well, very unstable period. Massive damage to infrastructure from the war, huge casualties, changes in workforce, in agriculture, in industry, in social conventions. Culturally, music. I mean, you get the British invasion, the early British invasion, including the Beatles from the early 60s. So, from this perspective, we might be saying that Harris's data set is looking specifically at a period of instability. This would fit with Belsky's interpretation that in unstable periods, try something different. Pay less attention to what your parents did, because for adults that of a generation before, say, World War II, before the 1950s, reach adulthood there and had developed their patterns of behavior, this probably wasn't working terribly well. There was unemployment, there were riots in the UK, and other parts of Europe as well, not just the UK, I should point out. North America, things were actually in some ways more stable. And in fact, if you take a look at some of the changes in, say, wait a minute, you know, youth of North America was pretty different, countercultural changes. Well, a bit of a lag on this. In fact, you know, some of the sort of British invasion, just to use pop culture referencing here, was so innovative and exciting to North America because it was so different. It was coming from without. They weren't generating this in the same way internally. So there's interesting issues here. Belsky says that, hey, look, I mean, the world, even if we leave aside some of these sort of cultural issues, even if we go back into the EEA, the world would go through periods of stability and instability. Environmental parameters would shift, weather patterns, whatnot. Consequently, Belsky argues that from an evolutionary perspective, it would be adaptive. Again, looking at this sort of variability of offspring, think back to our Red Queen hypothesis, the idea that having heterogeneity in your offspring is going to be beneficial to make your offspring a moving target with respect to parasites. But in the same way, if there is variability in your offspring with respect to how they respond to environmental stability and instability, how much they will imitate their parental generation, how much they will attend to peers, because that could be very adaptive. In periods of ecological instability, at least having some children that are not going to do what the parents did, that actually will be, you know, rabble-rousers, disruptive, produce lots of teen angst, and that's it, I'm moving out of the hut, that sort of thing. I'm moving into Thag's cave, and you can't stop me, okay, those sorts of big drama moments, might have been actually beneficial. Who knows? Maybe that actually is the right way to go. The river sticks, you know, with the parents at the hut, and it doesn't work out. Boom. All your offspring die. Your differential reproductive success goes to zero. Now, in terms of the mechanism for this, Belsky says, Ice ages. That could be the instability that comes and goes in the environment. Possibly, you know, I mean, that's... What about different ethnic groups, you know, or before the out of Africa period where Ice Age activity was fairly low? How much effect did Ice Age have on Central African structure? Hard to say. So, I mean, there's possibilities there, but we probably don't have to speculate something as dramatic as Ice Ages. It could potentially even be much smaller scale local environmental changes due to a number of things. Flooding, volcanic processes, new predators moving into an area, almost anything that produces that kind of instability. Could even be, you know, going back to Tangled Bank, new groups of humans moving into an area, and competition with members of your own species could produce that instability. All right. Let's shift and talk just a little bit here about morality as an aspect of social development. One of these areas that has been very, very much looked at over decades in terms of child psychology and educational psychology, developmental psychology, are aspects of the development of moral reasoning and morality, and how these are cultural norms and these sorts of things. Some people have seen this as being a bit of a problem for evolutionary psychology, because most evolutionary psychology argues that it's the individual that is going to be the unit of selection. And when we talk about things like morals, basically what we're talking about are culture-specific rules of behavior, it seems that this would be operating at the group level. So moral behavior seems to be working for the group, not down at the level of the individual. So does this cause a problem for evolutionary psychology interpretations? Not necessarily. Although there have been attempts to take moral behavior and say, well, I see here, this gives evidence of group selection. It's possible. But we don't need to postulate that. You've got to remember, I mean, what is a group? Well, a group is a collection of individuals. We've talked about things like, say, reciprocal altruism. And we can still talk about how reciprocal altruism is beneficial for an individual. We don't talk about reciprocal altruism necessarily as being a dyad or a collection of individuals involved there that make up a macro group, right? If you do something for someone else and they reciprocate, yes, individually you both benefit. If somebody cheats you, then you lose out and they benefit. Again, we go back to the individual. In a similar sort of way, we can look at moral behaviors, which are developed, say, as cultural parameters here, at the level of the individual, in that individuals comprise cultural groups, societies. If you have a good moral structure that keeps a culture going, keeps a group stable, well, who does that benefit? Well, it benefits the individuals in the group. Keep in mind as well, if we go back into the EEA, your individual group would have had a much higher proportion of close relatives in it. So anything that's benefiting the group benefits you, directly perhaps, and also is going to benefit you in terms of indirect, inclusive fitness. So group stability can be good. stable groups are probably safer groups. There's a variety of evidence for this, both from non-human animals and humans as well. If you've got a secure group, well, safe group, secure group, your offspring are more likely to survive. That's directly beneficial to individuals. If you can make predictions about the environment, if your group has got rules, moral regulations about the sharing of resources, tithes, these sorts of things, great. Even if times get more difficult for you as an individual, if you're part of the group that you have, if you will, bought into, subscribe to these morals, these rules and regulations, then you can draw on those in the future. So everybody benefits. Now, this can lead to, then, overall improved fitness of the individual. There's an interesting issue with this, of course. If we look at a variety of historical incidents, we find that, in fact, moral behavior often breaks down when it comes down to, shall we say, a threshold level, when it comes to the wire. Consider the Pilgrims, okay? The Mayflower colonists landed on Plymouth Rock. So, this is the Thanksgiving, story that the United States, the Americans, love to promote. So you have these religious individuals, the Pilgrims, that were horribly persecuted, driven out of England because, as I said, of religious bias and nastiness, end up on a ship, sail to North America to establish a new colony free of religious persecution, land on Plymouth Rock, barely survive the first winter due to the kindness of the Native Americans, and go on to make America great. Sure, excuse me. The actual history of this is rather different. Yes, the Pilgrims were religiously persecuted, but that was only after they tried to persecute as many other religious groups as they possibly could, back before the English Civil War. They eventually lost. Cromwell died, and the king came back. And frankly, the Pilgrims were jerks, when you come right down to it. I mean, they were religious fundamentalists. Okay, so they were fundamentalists in true sense of the word here. No one likes living with neighbors that are like, you have shiny buckles on your shoes, you're going to hell. It's really difficult to live with those people around you. So they didn't play well with others, let's say, all right? So they get on a ship. They actually weren't heading to Plymouth. They were supposed to be heading quite a bit further south, South Carolina, where it was actually warmer, where there was already an established English colony. The problem was they were so annoying on the ship that the captain got so tired of them telling him how everyone was sinning and the sailors were horrible, he kicked them off. Reached land, punted, he said, that's it, you're gone. Now, unfortunately for the other people that were on the ship, it wasn't entirely just Pilgrims. There was a bunch of individuals that had nothing to do with the Pilgrims that the captain, by this point, was so horribly frustrated, he put everyone over the side, and here you go, here's the provisions, good luck, bye-bye, and sailed away. Now, you've got this group now of religious fundamentalists, so a tight unit, tight group, okay? You got some outsiders, and you got winter coming in an area that they're not really prepared for. They're up further north, not as far north as we are, obviously, but, you know, further north. Nothing established. Yes, they do end up making some connections with the native groups, but it's very touch and go. In the first winter, in fact, no, the interesting thing from this, from a sort of scientific perspective, is we know the relationships. We know everyone that got landed at Plymouth Rock. We know all their names. We know the relationships to one another. We know who were family members, extended relatives. We've got all that information. And we know who is unrelated. So besides the poor buggers that just happened to be on the ship and got kicked off as well, that weren't related to anybody at all, the Pilgrims also had a bunch of, they basically be servants, staff with them, who, chambermaids and whatnot, who weren't related to anybody either. Okay, we get the first winter, right? Fundamentalist group. Morality should be really high. And it is. They're extremely pious. until they start starving. Now, here's what we know. The children that died, more children survived proportionally. More children survived the first winter than adults. Children that survived had at least one parent that survived. Very, very commonly, one of the parents died. What's happening here is kinsled altruism. Parents were starving themselves to give food to their children. If both parents died, the children died. Now, from a moral perspective and working within your group, orphan children should have been brought in and cared for by other members of this very moral society. But when you come down to it, so group versus the individual, direct fitness versus genetic altruism towards someone who's a member of your group, your brethren, but isn't directly related to you, what wins? Individual level selection. This is just one example. We've got plenty of other examples of this throughout history, and we have, so we've got real world evidence of this, and we have experimental evidence where people are given little thought experiments, and, you know, in the event of, although I don't think anyone's done this one exactly, it'd be fun to do, in the event of zombie apocalypse, who do you invite into your zombie-proof bunker, right? Friends, relatives, strangers that you've met on the street, these sorts of things. This sort of thing has been done with air raid shelters. Who would you invite into your air raid shelter with you? And again, it generally comes down to family. So individual tends to triumph over group when you come right down to the threshold. When you come right down to it. If times are good enough that you can be generous, by all means, that's what we find. If times are not that good, what has evolution produced? Focus on the individual. Okay. So, if we're at least somewhere above this baseline threshold, yeah, having a group around is pretty good. With respect to things like reciprocity and cheating. And this was something that was very confusing to early evolutionary theorists going back late 19th, early 20th century. And this was one of these things that they very much thought made humans unique. Right? We'll talk more about reciprocity and reciprocal arrangements later. But for a long time, it was assumed that this kind of behavior, the Good Samaritan effect, was uniquely human. That this took a higher cognitive process, a moral reasoning to engage in this. We now know there's all kinds of non-human animals that engage in reciprocal altruism. But let's just look at this sort of simplistically here. You've got a reciprocal arrangement. Both parties are going to benefit. Everybody wins. Right? If one individual in the reciprocal arrangement cheats, that individual benefits, the other loses. Okay, so there's a winner and a loser now. Any group, now we talked about the things that are necessary for reciprocal altruism. One, long enough lifespan. Two, ability to recognize individuals. Three, large enough sort of social group to make interactions frequent. If occasionally someone cheats in a reciprocal arrangement, okay. You can deal with that. If cheating becomes common, though, now there's no benefit to initiating a reciprocal interaction. So if you know the incidence of cheating is high, if it's like, I'm probably going to get cheated on this, why are you going to bother being the initiator? If someone says, hey, can you help me out? It's like, yeah, no. Really, I'll help you out later. It's like, yeah, I don't think so. You probably won't. I've been burned too often. Why would I do that? Okay. Now nobody benefits. We don't know. Maybe the individual would have reciprocated. Maybe they wouldn't. We'll never know. It's actually really difficult to have a social organization to produce structured social interactions if everyone is acting selfishly. By selfish behavior, we mean you benefit at the expense of others. That's how we define selfishness in evolutionary and biological theory. So you benefit, others lose. Societies can take a certain amount of selfishness, but if selfishness rises too high, the social group collapses. Because why would you interact with everyone else who's behaving selfishly? If everyone's being selfish, then there's no benefit to being in the group. All right? If a group breaks up, then there's all kinds of downsides. Well, if you're not living in a group, I mean, it's harder to find food, shared food gathering. It's perhaps harder to produce shelter, harder to protect from predators or other groups of humans. Child rearing becomes more difficult. Gaining mates, right? If nobody lives in a group, it's pretty hard to find people to date, let alone to show off your snazzy new courtship dance. Is anybody watching? No? Crap. Gotta go find a group. Oh yeah, we're all selfish bastards. Right, that's not gonna work. Okay? So, when this happens, groups will break up if there is too much cheating, if there is too little reciprocity involved. Marriages break up if there's too much cheating. Aw, okay, microcosm for larger group structures. Governments fall if they seem to be corrupt. We tolerate a certain amount of corruption in our governments, right? A certain amount of nepotism. Yeah, okay. Every government has a certain amount of corruption involved in nepotism, pushing a particular contract for an industry towards the MP's home riding or something like that, whatnot. We tolerate a certain amount of it. But if governments become too corrupt, at least in a democratic structure, they tend to fall. Why do we think, you know, we associate dictatorships with corrupt systems? You could have a benevolent dictatorship. Doesn't happen very often, because the temptation, if you have ultimate power, is to ultimately benefit you and yours. We can deal with a certain amount of this. But once it exceeds some threshold, the system collapses. So in this sense, the morality here, cultural rules by which to maintain a stable society, are beneficial to everyone within that society. If they are not, if individuals aren't benefiting, one of the things you see is defection. Individuals will leave unstable groups. Individuals will leave groups in which cheating is too high. They will try to get out of an area. They immigrate away from it. Again, plenty of real-world evidence about this. Now, your textbook talks about the origins of morality, variability of morality, issues of universal morality. It's actually very nicely covered in the text, so I'm going to just let you go through the text on that. There's a podcast, which I was going to show you today, but I can't get this silly thing working. So there's a podcast up. I think there's links to it someplace on the website. If not, I'll take a peek and find it. We did the podcast on the steroids there. There's one about morality as well. So if it's not up there, I'll find it for you. I'll put a link up. What I want to finish up this section talking about are what I call mirror neurons. When I first started talking about mirror neurons about 5 or 6 years ago, most people had never heard of them. In psychology, even at the third and fourth year level. Most people are familiar with them now, so just quick review here. Mirror neurons, neurons scattered throughout, in humans at least, premotor cortex, centers for language, empathy, pain, all over. They're through a great deal of our brain. When we look at non-human primates, they are more restricted, a lot of motor centers, perceptual centers here, but humans have got mirror neurons throughout. What they do is, these are neurons that will fire not only when the subject, the individual, performs an action or thinks some thought, but when the individual observes someone else do this. So basically, mirror neurons are involved in mental imitation of witnessed or heard, of somehow observed actions. So they're involved in observational learning. Now again, going back to issues of how do children learn about things like the current environment, make predictions about the future? Well, so much of this comes back to observational learning. Children are observational sponges. Before mirror neurons, it was just like,
Isn't that amazing?
I was like, oh. Well, you know, we've actually got neural systems specifically evolved to make us really good at learning from others. You start looking at this and thinking about the delayed life history development for humans, how it's so drawn out, and you start to go, huh. And what do you know? Humans have, as far as we can tell, more mirror neurons than any other species we've looked at. It's like, starting to see, you know, some interesting connections here. Being around other people, observing other people, learning by observing. Brain evolved to do that. Drawn out life history, giving plenty of time to observe others, be they parents, be they peer groups. Discovered by mirror neurons were discovered completely by accident by Rizzolatti, Galese, and Fagassi. They published on this in 1996 and were more or less ignored for about 4 years outside of kind of the primate perceptual motor community. Wasn't until we get into sort of the early 2000s that this really started being picked up on by mainstream psychology and specifically human-related psychology. So what they were doing was good old-fashioned single-cell recording. So very traditional, stick an electrode into a neuron, see if you can stimulate some perceptual system such that that neuron fires. So basically they were mapping the visual motor cortex in macaque monkeys, and they did it in a very simple way. They put a raisin on the table, they shove an electrode into some monkey neurons, and they'd wait for the monkey to reach out, pick up the raisin, and eat it, and they'd see which neurons would fire. So they were looking for, in this particular case, neurons that would fire with the monkey seeing a raisin and reaching for a raisin. So I got a monkey's wired up here. Somebody walked into the room and said, hey, what are you doing? And well, I can't remember which one, Rizzolatti or whoever said, oh, yeah. Well, you know, pretend I'm the monkey. You know, there's a raisin on the table. I reach out, eat the raisin. And we're, beep. What the heck? They've got the monkey wired up. They didn't bother turning the recording system off. The guy's demonstrating, you know, he's playing the monkey. He demonstrates reaching out, picking up the raisin, and eating it to the other human who wants to know what's going on. That monkey's neuron fires. Did the monkey reach for something? No, arm didn't move. Try it again. Put a raisin on the table. Human reaches out, picks it up. Bam. Monkey neuron fires. Like, well, that's weird. They knew this is a neuron that fired when the monkey reached. They discover it is also a neuron that fires when the monkey sees somebody else reach for a raisin. They then go off and look at this in other contexts, and sure enough, there are neurons that will respond to not just doing a motor action yourself, but observing somebody else do that motor action. So these were initially found in the macaque premotor cortex. Over the next, say, 6 years or so, more and more locations for mirror neurons are discovered. And in humans, we're not usually slamming electrodes into people's brains just to poke around in there. Most people are kind of like, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea. So we do things like MRI, fMRI recordings, where we see what parts of the brain light up. It's not as fine-tuned. I mean, even the best fMRI is giving you a voxel, that's a three-dimensional pixel, of a bit less than a square millimeter. So we can't take this down to individual neurons, but you can get individuals to do something and then have them watch somebody else do it, and we can at least see parts of the brain down to a pretty fine scale that are activating as well. So we have a pretty good idea where these are, although not down to the individual neuron level. So we do know that in humans there's mirror neurons in the premotor cortex involved in all types of motor, the inferior parietal areas, so perception, posterior parietal lobe, superior temporal sulcus, insula. And some of these are involved not just in movement patterns, but in terms of comprehending things like feelings, intentionality, and language use. So all things that are very significant. You know, we've talked about social cognition. We find a lot of mirror neurons in the parts of the human brain that we've already identified through other processes as being involved in social cognition. Now, this becomes very interesting in terms of learning, childhood developmental development of morality even, right? How do you acquire your morality? Often by actual observation. If you are surrounded by people who actually follow societal rules, children are more likely to follow the societal rules. If you're around people that say one thing but don't actually do that behavior, the children learn the rules, but they don't follow them. Again, observation becomes very significant here. What is demonstrated? Again, we've got these specific neurons that allow us to do this. So this is involved in learning based upon imitation, understanding the meaning and intention of various actions. Again, something that humans are very good at. By the 2004-2005, we're starting to get into some very interesting studies, and these just continued over the years, with respect to mirror neuron functionality and humans. Interesting. So in terms of some of the early work, going back to like maybe 2003 or so, when they found mirror neurons in parts of the brain involved in language, in terms of these match up with, this would match up with part of the macaque brain that's involved in throwing. And so I remember when I was, 2004, going back about 7 years teaching evolutionary psychology, one of the ideas was this was seen as giving support to the what's called the gestural theory of language. Question, we'll get to language later on in the term here. We'll get to language next week. There's terms on the term. Issue with language, does it involve, develop from oral communication of some sort, or was it based on gestures, hand signs? And so when mirror neurons that were found that corresponded to a macaque throwing area, the suggestion was, you see, so in earlier primates, you've got mirror neurons involved in throwing, the macaque part of the brain that seems to correspond to Broca's is the F5 region of the macaque, that corresponds to language centers. So you see, language evolved out of vocal, gestural processes. Turns out it probably doesn't work quite that way, given that we now know that these mirror neurons do a lot of stuff other than just motor behavior. So Galiz and colleagues, 2005, had human subjects listen to sentences. So they're listening now to sentences that are describing actions. They find that the same mirror neurons fire when listening to these descriptions of actions as would have fired had the subject actually done the action, him or herself, or if they had seen the action perform. What's interesting about this is the first evidence that mirror neurons actually respond to abstract representations, language. So that's really interesting. And again, with respect to linguistical development, and why is it that it's so hard to teach, say, a chimpanzee language or a dolphin language or anything else? Well, they probably don't have as many of the mirror neurons as we do. This may be one of those things, for whatever reason, and again, this becomes somewhat speculative as what sort of started the cascading effect that led to having more and more and more mirror neurons being adaptive. But it seems that this is significant. So they allow for us to learn, or they at least assist in learning, language. Iacombi and colleagues, also in 2005, suggest that we should think about mirror neurons in terms of what they call sets. Okay, so think back, we talked about proper and actual domains with respect to modules. Similar sort of concept here. So you see how things are kind of linking together. So Iacombi says we should talk about what's called a basic set. And a basic set corresponds to an action's most, if you will, essential form. So reaching for something. A supplemental set, though, is our mirror neurons that will selectively fire according to an action's perceived purpose. So not just what are you doing, but why are you doing it? Are you reaching out to pick up a glass to drink from it? Or are you reaching out to pick up a glass to clear away a mess on a table? Very different action. Intentionality, right? This takes us into intentionality. It's not just what you do, but what do you mean? Okay. And again, that goes into social cognition. We humans have more of these mirror neurons than any other primates, and we have them in more locations, certainly more in the prefrontal cortex than any other primates we've currently looked at. And our issues with respect to intentionality and social cognition are better than any of the other non-human primates that have been observed. Chimpanzees can lie to one another. They're just not really as good at it as we are. So there was a lovely study that years ago where a bunch of chimps in a room, and chimps could look through it's a glass window, the curtain that could be drawn above. And basically what would happen was a human would go in and hide some food someplace in the room. Now, let the chimpanzees look through the window and watch the human do this. As soon as you open the door, go, okay, there you go. The chimps go running off, and whoever gets there first gets the food. Okay. Then what they did is they would take and carry a chimp with them. So the human would take a chimp by the hand, take a chimp with them as they went and hid food. Okay. You go... If the other chimps are watching at the window, again, it just becomes a race. But keep the window open. So a human walks in with the chimp. Close the curtains on the window. Human walks with the chimp someplace in the room, hides the food. Comes back out. Okay? They got a little group of chimps there. Open the door. And they go. Vroom, the chimps run. But they don't know where the food is. The one chimp that went into the room with the human does. So while the other chimps are running around in the room trying to find the food, this chimp goes over and just gets the food. Doesn't take too many trials before the other chimps figure out that one chimp knows where the food is, and so they start paying attention. Where does it look like that chimp is walking towards? And they try to get there first. Now, not all chimps can do this, but after a while of this, at least some of the chimps that were taken into the room first and shown where the food was hidden, would start to essentially lie to their companions. So let's say the food was actually hidden behind that garbage can over there. So the door opens, the chimps come in, and I'm the chimp that knows where the food is. I start walking this direction, and I'm going slowly. All the other chimps, hooting excitedly, tear past me. It's like, duh. Yay, over here, and get the fruit. Not all of them can do it. Not all of them can do it well. So they can lie, but they're not as good at it as we are. Whatever that says about us as a species, better or worse. But, I mean, it gets into Machiavellian intelligence. How badly do you really want that fruit? Right? Okay. So, intentionality. A study by Wicker looked at issues of mirror neurons and empathy. So considered issues of, say, feeling disgust. So there's all kinds of ways of generating disgust in subjects. Could be done by, very common, easy way to do it is by scent. You can use various things that smell really bad, like rotting food or feces, things like that. Give that smell. Generates a feeling of disgust. If you show people a picture of somebody else's face, giving a disgusted expression, we find that the same mirror neurons get activated. And these are mirror neurons in the insula. So this activates the same set. What this seems to do is allow a direct understanding of somebody else's emotional state. If we are watching somebody else's face and we see them do a particular emotional response, happiness, sadness, disgust, anger, whatever it is, we can understand that emotion, not just intellectually, but we actually feel it. Some people have a horrible time watching, for example, sitcoms that are based upon really embarrassing social effects. They actually feel like they have to leave the room when one of the characters is being, you know, horribly embarrassed on screen, because it makes them feel horribly embarrassed. Suggestion here, and what makes sense now, is like, you know, it's just an actor, right? Yes. You know that this is just scripted. Yes. You know this is a TV show. Yes. Why do you feel embarrassed? I just do. Activating the same mirror neurons. Even though this person is an actor, oh, that person's been horribly embarrassed. They feel horrible shame. They've been humiliated. Boom. Generates that same feeling in the individual watching. This is what we call empathy. Empathy is the ability to feel somebody else's, to directly experience somebody else's emotional state. What this does for humans is it provides good social cohesion. For better or worse, you know, you can get someone riling a crowd up, right? Saying all the right things, acting excitedly, generating a lot of excitement in the crowd, and then you turn them loose, you know, you got a mob, suddenly you turn them loose on something, right? Works because if you got someone demonstrating an excited emotion, demonstrating a bit of anger in there, other people observing this feel it as well. Good mob leaders use this. Good revolutionaries make use of this. Doesn't always work, though. One of the areas where we think we've got a group of individuals that have got, to a greater or lesser degree, mirror neuron failure are autistics. So, given what we think, well, about to say no, but given what, you know, technically we think mirror neurons are doing in humans, language, empathy, social cognition, intentionality, does this sound like the kind of stuff that autistics have problems with? Yeah. Well, we know there's nothing blatantly wrong with an autistic's brain. I mean, it's not like they're missing big chunks of prefrontal cortex. It's not like, oh, there's the problem. Broca's, you know, half of your Broca's area is just gone. I mean, it's nothing obvious. The effects are subtle in this sense. Now, mirror neuron trouble could really play into this. Mirror neuron, we know that mirror neurons are involved in language, learning, observational learning, empathy, social cognition, theory of mind, all of this stuff. And that's the same problems that autistics have. Autistic children, so studies have been done over the last, you know, few years here that show that autistic kids actually show less mirror neuron activity than normal children when watching something really simple, like basic finger moving. Really simple thing you do, just have someone tap a finger. Just wiggle a finger, okay? If you're watching me wiggle my finger, your mirror neurons are firing. That would be involved in, you know, if you wiggled your finger, if you did this. Try wiggling your finger. Do you feel those neurons firing? Of course you don't. right? But, I mean, they are. And when I do this and you look at it, some of those same neurons are doing the same thing there. But if you do this with autistics, you know, you do it with normal kids and sure enough, put them in fMRI and part of the brain lights up with this when they do it themselves or when they watch you do it. But autistics in that situation, it happens when they do it. So when they wiggle their finger, sure, you got the neurons, the motor cortex involved in that. But when they watch somebody do it, either almost nothing or it's reduced over the normal group. So this is what we call a basic set failure. Both autistics and non-autistic teens, for example, though, can imitate and identify distinctive facial expressions. So you can have, you know, higher functioning autistics here that they know. I mean, you know, they've got some language abilities here. They know it. So it's like, okay, what facial expression is this? Anger. What facial expression is this? Happiness. What facial expression? Okay, so they know what the expressions are. They can identify. But unlike the normal teens, the autistics don't show any mirror neuron activity. When shown these faces, they can identify them. So cognitively, you know, just in terms of a straight cognitive, they know what the expressions are. In terms of, if you will, the sort of social cognitive empathy side of things, They don't experience the emotion, though. That person is showing, you know, joy. Well, it's hard to socially engage with somebody else. Yeah, they're happy. Doesn't that make you feel happy? Why? If I had cake, I'd be happy, but they have cake. Why would I be happy? Right. Most people are happy when somebody else has something nice happen to them. It's like, oh, isn't that sweet? Right? Generally not autistics. Okay? So they don't feel the empathy here. Now, we don't know exactly why. There's a couple of possibilities here. One possibility is that autistics just have less mirror neurons than normal. Just born that way. Not sure. Another possibility is that, well, two possibilities here, and they're related, is that they start out with the same complement of mirror neurons, but these mirror neurons may require a higher threshold of activation. Have you ever heard of the neuronal use it or lose it theory? Neural tissue is expensive. If you're not actually using it for something, your body just reabsorbs it. Doesn't bother putting the energy into it. We go through a lot of what's called programmed cell death, apoptosis, in the early, you know, first few years of life. Stuff that's not being used is pruned back. So a possibility here is that for autistics, they start out with the same number of mirror neurons as everyone else, but the threshold for activation is higher. And so without having some really intensive social stimulation, lots of exposure that can be involved in observational learning, these neurons don't fire often enough. And if they're not firing, if you're not crossing threshold, body goes, well, that's a useless bit of neural architecture. Let's prune that out and use that energy for something else. Why keep this neural network there? It's not doing anything. Now, if we look at what, you know, one of the, I'm not saying it's a great therapeutic technique for autism, but it's about the only one that really works much, is just intensive social interaction. High intensity, one-on-one, working with behavioral therapists. There's a few drug therapies that are out there as well that may help a bit, but really, since going back into the 1950s, best thing that worked then is still just about the best thing that works now, is just a lot of social involvement. Now, if you've got autistics, that the problem, you know, hypothetical problem here, is their mirror neurons aren't crossing threshold. Well, if you're giving lots of attention, if you're forcing them to make eye contact, if you're forcing the child into the social engagement, maybe forcing them above that threshold. They activate, they're maintained. Yeah?
That suggests that the treatment is not as effective at later stages of life?
Yes. This would, in fact, suggest that treatment will not be as effective at later stages of life. Exactly. And, in fact, evidence supports that. The earlier autism can be diagnosed and behavioral intervention can be begun, generally speaking, the better the results. And this, historically, has been a problem because often, especially for boys, which make up, you know, most of the autistics, we go back in time a bit. Diagnosis of autism may not have been made until the boy was 3.5, 4 years old. Often it was based upon, you know, the language skills just don't seem to be there. But boys, compared to girls, have a delayed language anyways. Girls start talking earlier and generally use more complicated language. Think back, we talked about intentionality here, right? There's a difference in terms of, as well, what provides reinforcement. Boys and girls respond differently. Boys get reinforced by successful competition. Girls' brains, different wiring, social cohesion. So being part of group provides much more reinforcement there. If adults are talking to you and talking, you want to do that, you're part of the group, that leads, you know, lights up the dopamine system in the girl's brain. And again, we go back to the idea of, you know, I think there's an exam question on that one, you know, better multitasking, better language skills, better intentionality. Girls are, and women, by extension, are good at this stuff. They probably evolved to be really good at it. You know, boys are not better at everything. There we go. But if we have to wait until the child's 3.5, 4 years old, and then a bit later to be able to get into a behavioral program, 4.5. Yeah, at that point, if this mirror neuron hypothesis and the threshold and the use it or lose it is correct, we've probably lost a lot of the necessary mirror neurons by this point. So there's some interesting stuff that's being done to try to diagnose autism earlier. One study I read about took and played random generated computer noise to infants, or computer noise that followed a cadence of motherese. So you know motherese, the way baby talk to kids, called motherese. Okay, not necessarily real words. Every language has its own version of motherese that uses some of the real words, but it follows the cadence, the pattern of language. Now, they give children a choice. They were working with children that were about 18 months old. Longitudinal study. Which did they prefer? Just the random computer noise or the motherese type noise? They found some children did not show a preference. Okay. Track over a few years, DSM them, a few years later for autism, they find there's a higher correlation. Basically, if you didn't prefer motherese, if you showed no preference between the random noise and the motherese noise, much more likely to be autistic, diagnosed as autistic. So, what's the implication here? Give this test, simple test. If you've got a child that's not showing a marked preference towards the motherese, put them at 18 months into some intensive behavioral therapy. You go, wait, what if they're actually not autistic? What if they were just having a bad day or something? So what? I mean, like, what's the worst that's going to happen? Well, you'll have a hyper-socialized child who'll be really good with language. Oh. Yeah, that doesn't suck. Yeah, there isn't really a downside, except for the cost, right? That you have to have the therapist, you have to have the time, you have to... But I mean, from the, you know, just a second. It's not like we're, like, it's like, well, they might be autistic. Let's slam this drug into the kid and see what that does. It's like, the worst that happens is they get played with a lot and talked to a lot and socialized with a lot. And maybe we reduce the incidence of autism. Yeah?
At what age is autism usually diagnosed?
As a historically, sort of going back through, you know, 1970s, 1980s, usually for males, this would be like maybe 3.5 to 4.5, because it's really only perhaps, well, it's just not much of a talker. And again, I mean, as you know, I know, you know, there's a range of degrees of autism there, so a high functioning versus low functioning, there's going to be a lot of difference here. But often it wouldn't be until after 3.5 years of age, which at this point is getting kind of late. So efforts are being made to try to find ways, techniques of diagnosing earlier. I mean, again, the issue is if the traditional way of doing this is based on language, you got an 18-month-old child, well, there's not a lot of language there to begin with, so you can't use that. So finding things like this preference for random computer noise or motherese-style noise, that's very exciting. That's very interesting. Okay. All right, so that was the end of...
I have a question.
Yeah.
Does that actually reduce their threshold for mirror neurons?
No. The idea is, well, again, this is hypothetical. The idea that there's a threshold here for activation. We know that neurons have different thresholds for activation. How much neurotransmitter is required before an action potential is sent by that particular neuron. We don't know the differences in human thresholds for activation in mirror neurons in autistics or non-autistics, because, I mean, again, we're not putting electrodes into humans usually. It's like, yes, we think we've got an autistic child. Can we cut their head open and stick electrodes into their brain? No? Right, thanks. Just thought we'd ask. So, tough to do. So, this is an inference. It's possible, through issues of long-term potentiation and whatnot, that this could, in intensive training, could reduce threshold. It may be more likely that if this is actually keeping these neurons, that it gets them beyond a critical period maintains them long enough that we've kept them through a critical developmental period. Once synaptic connections are established, it's perhaps less likely for that neuron to be pruned out and removed. There's other evidence in support of that as well. Neurons that are highly integrated are less likely to be lost through apoptosis. So we don't know exactly is the short answer. It's possible that they could reduce threshold for activation, but if this theory is correct, it's more likely that what it does is just integrate those mirror neurons into a network, set up stronger synaptic connections, which is then what subsequently maintains their presence. Okay. So chapter 7, as you can not see, takes us into altruism, kin selection, and parenting. And I've got a feeling this is going to... Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that's right. This will work for this. I don't need them. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so our let's go back. We talked about these briefly earlier on in the term. Basic altruism, also sometimes called kin-selected altruism, or just altruism. It's unfortunate that these all have the similar names, but there we go. So either it's altruism, basic altruism, or kin-selected altruism. What biologists and evolutionary psychologists mean when we talk about this is a case where there is a cost to yourself and somebody else benefits. Now, one of the things with the evolutionary psychology interpretation on this is that it doesn't require intent. It doesn't require any sort of necessity for higher cognitive processing or understanding here, right? This could be evolved strictly through kin selection. Those individuals, for whatever little random reason, favor kin over non-kin, will probably pass more of their genes on. Over the long run, those that have this predisposition to assist closer family members, closer relatives, will propagate more genes. The trait will spread through the population. We'll have altruism, basic altruism, then evolve. So this goes back to, I mean, we talked about Hamilton's rule, RB greater than C. Right. So again, I mean, we see this in social insects. I mean, do you think a worker ant really cognitively understands what's going on? I mean, leaving aside Disney movies about, you know, ants and whatnot and a bug's life, I mean, leaving that kind of stuff aside and our anthropomorphizing of ants, no. I mean, they just don't have that many neurons. How many neurons does an ant have? Well, it depends on the species, but anything from maybe 90,000 neurons up to maybe 500,000 neurons. That's not very much, okay? A lot of that's going into the visual system and other perceptual systems. So, but we don't need a cognitive understanding of what it means, of why you're doing this. We just need some sort of mutation to have occurred that for whatever reason, individuals favored kin more than non-kin. Could be ferimental imprinting, which is in fact what happens with ants. Could be any number of things. So there are what are called obligate slave maker ants. My all-time favorite ant, Polyergus brevisips. Okay, it's a obligate slave maker. The only way Polyergus brevisips can survive is to attack other ant colonies, carry off their eggs and larvae and pupa, and raise them up as slaves. Now, the Polyergus brevisips are some red ants, and they often attack Formica ants, which are black ants. And so, you know, obviously we've got the whole microcosm of North America reflected here. There's nothing racist about this. They just have to do this sort of thing. Interesting. So you say, well, why don't you have like a Spartacus ant? Why doesn't one of the Formica little black ants rise up and lead a slave revolt against the oppressive Polyergus overlords, or actually overladies, as it turns out? Because of olfactory imprinting. Once the larva, the pupa, are brought into the Polyergus colony, they go through an imprinting period, and each ant produces its own particular, each species of ant produces its own olfactory cues, chemical signature. Ants don't really recognize one another by sight. They do it olfactory, by smell. They have a lot of glands in their abdomen that produce particular scents. Well, the larva and pupa imprint onto the dominant scent in the colony that they are raised in. If you liberate black ants out of the red Polyergus nest, take them back to the nest they came from, the other black ants will tear them apart because they smell like a Polyergus. Okay? So, if it's something as simple like that, simply imprint onto predominant pheromone cues, it's a really easy way of identifying kin from non-kin. And if you congregate with things that smell like you as opposed to don't smell like you, you're just more likely to be assisting kin from non-kin. So potentially very easy, requires no cognitive processing on this at all. So really all basic altruism, kin-selected altruism has to do is provide benefits in terms of differential reproductive success here through indirect fitness. Now, when we talk about the sacrifice, so there's a cost to the individual, a benefit to somebody else. What we're usually looking at here is this difference between direct and indirect fitness. So if I sacrifice for a family member, this is reducing my direct fitness. So even with my children, if I put more energy and resources into my children, that is taking away from energy and resources I could be putting into having more children. Now, from a strictly direct fitness benefit, I can have the greatest direct fitness just by having as many children as possible. It doesn't necessarily mean I'll have the greatest differential reproductive success, as it turns out. So my sacrifice in terms of looking after my kids is I reduce my direct fitness. The benefit is perhaps they have a greater chance of reproductive success in the future by having more resources put into them, perhaps being healthier in our society, having money for college or university or starting up a trade or something like that, or whatever. But this is one of these little issues here. So we talk about there's a reduction in the individual's fitness, at least in the direct immediate sense, but over the long term, this leads to an increased differential reproductive success. So, you know, we talk about this being a cost to the self and a benefit to somebody else, but over the long term, the self really benefits from this, right? Because it increases the genes that are passed on. All right? So you got your direct and indirect fitness together to make up your inclusive fitness. We've talked about the coefficient of relatedness R, okay? And then if we come in and bring in Hamilton's rule, the RB greater than C, this explains our kin-selected altruism. Okay, so that's just any case where selection operates on an individual in any way that increases, or pardon me, affects the frequency of genes shared by common descent and relatives. And so if we do this, if I sacrifice but it benefits my offspring, as long as this benefit is great enough, there's an increase in my differential reproductive success. Over the long, and again, remember I said this earlier, with Hamilton's rule here, Hamilton's rule really doesn't apply to individuals per se. It says over evolutionary time, assuming that more often than not, RB is going to be greater than C, you will get these altruistic traits, whatever the genetics are, propagating through the population. So kin selection. Now, this is what I say here. Depending how you approach this, I mean, the simple definition is cost to self, benefit to someone else. But depending how you look at it, from either approximate or an ultimate level of interpretation here, we get a very different, you know, sort of view of this. At the proximate level, sacrificing, so my sacrificing to benefit my children, that's kin-selected altruism. I am sacrificing my kids' benefit. Right? So if we look at it this way here, you know, we've got an individual here that's the active unit or agent here. The donor, me, loses. The recipient, my kids, gain. There we go. That's our basic definition. But if we take this down, you know, at a more ultimate level, this starts to look a little bit more like, it's not exactly selfish behavior, because in selfish behavior, the donor wins and everyone else loses. So I probably on this slide really should have put selfish up in scare quotes here. It's not really selfish. It looks less altruistic and closer to them, because by sacrificing, you know, it's like, oh, I've cut down on the number of future kids I can have, and I put the resources into the children. But look, I actually win in the long run. Well, I hope I do. We'll find out. You know, see what happens to the kids. But you got the chance of winning. So by doing this, by reducing my direct fitness, I actually gain in terms of my inclusive fitness and differential reproductive success. By putting more resources into my current offspring in the present environment, might make it more likely that they will go on and have offspring as well. So I win. Right? Now, if we take this down into the level of the genes, we'll go back to our selfish gene interpretation here. Our donor loses out in terms of direct fitness, but gains enough indirect fitness, if you will, to offset the long-run loss. So we go down to our selfish gene view of things, and altruism, again, works at the level of the selfish gene. Now, we've got some interesting things that come out of this. So, for example, domestic violence. About 25% of murders varies a little bit from culture to culture and time to time, but on average, about 25% of murders involve family members. So domestic violence, domestic disputes. Now, when you look at this, you go, whoa, that's a lot. And sorry, Dr. Snyder, you've just been going on about how important kin-selected altruism is. Doesn't domestic violence work against that if you're killing off your family members? Well, not really. As it turns out, about 4 in 5 of domestic murders are of relatives by marriage. So unless, you know, we've got a deliverance thing, where you're ancestrally inbreeding with relatives, if you kill off your husband or your wife or your in-laws, you're not actually killing off anyone that's related to you by genetics. I mean, not close genetics. I mean, you're all part of the same species. But you're not actually damaging individuals that have a close, high R value. So at 4 in 5 murders involve relatives, but not blood relatives, right? Our language is somewhat imprecise on this. You know, well, relatives are relatives. Well, do we mean actual biological family members or non-biological family members? 4 out of 5 of the domestic murders, non-biological family members. From that point of view, go ahead, kill away. It's not affecting you. Okay, there's other downsides to that, right? You know, like prison. Be one. All right. So only about 1 in 5 of domestic murders are relatives by blood, so direct kin. Okay. And there's a beautiful graph here, which you can't see, but put this up. Slants downwards. We got spouses, other non-relatives, kids, parents, and let's see, other biological relatives. So the red on, if you've got this graph printed out or look at it in PowerPoint, the red, the last three columns there, represent biological relatives. The blue represents non-biological relatives, the first two columns. And the y-axis here is a relative risk of being killed by somebody in your family. So what we see here is that the risk is really high on the non-biological relatives, which is not to say that you don't end up occasionally seeing cases where individuals off biological family members. Offspring, pretty low. I mean, you know, you're much more likely actually to kill off a parent, about twice as likely to kill off one of your parents as you are as one of your kids. About half as likely to kill off other other biological relatives like aunts or uncles or cousins or whatnot. Probably just proximity. You're probably just not around them as much. But look at it this way, you know, what about the killing off, you know, twice as likely to, and the likelihood's still pretty low, right, but twice as likely to end up killing off a parent as a child. How can we fit that with an evolutionary interpretation? There we go. Yeah, what are you going to get out of a parent at this point? If you're at a point where, if you're old enough to probably kill off your parent, you're probably in your reproductive period yourself. So, direct versus, you know, your indirect, maybe your parent could still have some more kids, or maybe your parent could invest and assist you with the rearing of your child, or maybe if they're gone, you can get all of their stuff and put it into your own kids. Obviously, this gets more complicated. We've got cases where the parent may be suffering from a debilitating disease. So these get obviously a lot more complicated. But interesting, we know cultural anthropology, looking at more indigenous cultures or non-industrialized cultures, in many cultures, it is accepted that if times are hard and it comes down to somebody starving, it's the elderly that are culturally expected to take themselves off into the jungle, the desert, the ice floe, and sacrifice themselves so that the food can go into the younger generation. They go, whoa, that's harsh. Yeah, by our standards it is. But again, from these, you know, from groups that are existing very close to subsistence, you know, where that risk of hitting threshold and having starvation, having to pick who lives and who dies, from this point of view, who's more valuable in terms of propagating the genes? Younger generation. You know Rick Mercer? Used to be on 22 Minutes. Now he's just got the Rick Mercer Report, so a Canadian comedian. Back when he was on 22 Minutes, again, I can't even call it up and find you this, but because our thing is dead. But he used to have an episode called Talking to Americans. And he'd go down into the States, and he'd ask just absurd questions of Americans and get the response on it. And I remember watching these, and it's like, no, really. I mean, you've got to be cherry picking. I mean, my extended family's all in the States, and it's like, seriously, you can't have people that are this gormless. And he said, you know, I saw an interview with him. He's like, yeah, you know, we really thought we'd have to go down and film for weeks to get enough Americans that got this wrong. But actually, we were done with our filming for each episode in like a day or two. It was really surprising. We got that many just absurd. So one of the ones here was, he was asking people if they'd sign a petition to prevent the Canadian practice of putting our elderly on ice floes to die. So once you cross a certain age, you know, retirement, we just take you up to the Arctic, put you in an ice floe, go bye, and push you out to sea. And it's horrible. Of course I'll sign that. That's terrible. What an awful thing to do. Of course, he also had another one. It's like, will you sign a petition to prevent the traditional hunting and killing of caribou by Timbits? Where the caribou, of course, run through Vancouver every spring, and the indigenous traditional way of harvesting the herd is to pelt them to death with Timbits. That seems so cruel. How can you do that? Well, on the other hand, if it is their indigenous way of life, well, I guess that's their native customs. Yeah. Anyways, terrifically amusing, but the relevant one here is not the Timbits and the caribou, but the relevant one is this idea of putting our elder in ice floes to die. And we don't do this, right? But, I mean, Inuit society has great respect to the elder, for the elders, you know? Massive respect for the elders. But the elders also, you know, traditionally, it's like, okay, if someone's going to die here, who's it going to be? It's going to be the elderly. They're done the reproductive lifespan, the contribution they get. And again, you know, the very interesting thing we see with this is when we're looking at, you know, these cultural anthropology examinations of this, we're not dealing with people that, you know, it's like, oh yes, actually I have a PhD in evolutionary psychology and I can explain to you why our culture does this. Right? It's like, these are just people that are part of a culture that have never heard of evolutionary psychology before. They've just figured it out in the same way that, you know, they have... traditional medicine knows very interesting things about the risk of childhood fatality correlating with various birth defects and things. That was another one, interesting one we get here. So, within family alliances, we find that mothers and sons are much more likely to ally against the father than, say, fathers and sons or fathers and daughters are to work together against a mother. Now, Freud wrote about this a lot. So it's Freud's Oedipus complex. So if you've done any Freud or heard of Freud, yeah, the Oedipus complex. It's like, yeah, well, said Sigmund. So you see what happens is... the son wants to either castrate or kill his father so that he can take his father's place and have sex with his mother. Really? Oh, yeah. Seriously. Yeah, yeah, the Greeks wrote about it. It's like, Now, if you realize that Freud was actually having an affair with his wife's sister, you might start to realize that he was a little bit hung up on issues of sex. And maybe we should look for another interpretation here. But the Oedipus complex ties into this. Now, as I said, Freud's idea on this one is that there's sexual competition between fathers and sons for the access to the mothers, to the mom. This is probably not correct. There could be competition between fathers and sons for access to, say, the son's girlfriend, because, you know, you got 16-year-old, 17-year-old male. You've got maybe mid-30s-year-old father now, 40s still, you know, still prime, older, lots of resources, better position. From the 17-year-old girl's perspective, who's got more resources? Dad stealing son's girl? Yeah, it happens. Okay, so, but it's probably not about, you know, getting rid of dad to get access to mom. Might be, you know, my dad stole my girlfriend. Next on Montel. Okay. Talk shows are great, you know, these things are wonderful. Not Oprah. She was too, you know, pretentious about stuff. You know. Early Oprah was trashy as hell. It was great because you got into this stuff, but, you know. Oh, Montel's good for this kind of... Montel's great for you know, psychology. Maury Povich, great for you know, evolutionary psychology because they're so completely unself-conscious about how trashy they are. But there's kernels of reality in there. Anyways, so let's take a look at Freud's Oedipus complex, not based on Freud, but based on an evolutionary interpretation. So let's consider, as we said before, over 75% of cultures... that are around, are permissive of polygamy, so males having multiple females. And it really comes down to resources. If a male's got enough resources to support multiple wives, then by all means, go ahead. Well, older males in a society, not really old males, but older males, 30s, 40s, are probably going to have more resources than, you know, the 15 to 20-year-old males. All right. Now, let's even think about this, perhaps not you say, okay, well, that's fine. That's polygamous cultures. So there's competition here between the dad and son or sons for access to the younger females, right? Multiple additional wives. Okay. Well, you said 75% of cultures, but frankly, that's not the majority of the world's actual population now. No, okay. So let's just consider instead, polygamy, but let's just consider, say, extra-pair copulations cheating. So you've even got an ostensibly monogamous culture, and you've got the father that's going to be cheating and producing, well, bastard children. We use bastard in the technical term, which means born out of wedlock. All right. Now, dad's got a certain amount of resources here. From dad's point of view, and let's even assume dad's pretty sure that all the kids that, you know, are claimed to be his are in fact his. To a degree. So let's even just in this hypothesis assume that our paternal uncertainty is relatively low. So from this point of view, dad could put resources into any of his children. Right? He's got wife and then mistress. He's got kids from both. He's biologically related to all. Who should he put the resources into? Well, maybe he spreads the resources between all of his kids, wife and mistresses. Or maybe he decides he likes some better than others. Maybe he doesn't make it an even distribution. All right? Now, we get into this sort of situation here. So, wife knows that she is genetically related to her children. Wife also knows that she is not genetically related to mistress's children. Dad knows, or at least let's assume that parental uncertainty is very low, so dad's pretty sure he's related to his wife's children and his mistress's children. Wife's son, don't need to make a flowchart? No, good. Wife's son knows that he's related to mom, probably related to dad, wants to get resources from dad, but if dad's going to stick his resources into his mistress's kids, in other words, son's half-siblings, he's losing out. Whose interests coincide? Wife and her children or son's interests coincide. They don't want the resources going to the mistress's kids. That's taking them directly away from them. Okay. So, historical example. Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. There's a lovely little movie about this called Lion in Winter, been done a couple of times, but here's the actual history. There's some pictures that you can see on the PowerPoint slides. The bottom one is a picture of Eleanor from actually the time when she was alive. The top one of Henry II is from painted significantly a long time after he was dead. I think it's a 17th, 16th century portrait, so actually has things like perspective and depth and whatnot. So anyways, Henry was king of England from 1154 to 1189. I will not ask you these dates on an exam. Don't worry about it, okay? I'm not even going to ask you about the particular details of this. It's just a little story to help set things up. All right, so king of England, 1154 to 1189. Married Eleanor in 1152, so 2 years before he becomes king, 2 years before his dad dies. Eleanor was about 12 years older than Henry, but he fell madly in love with her. She was beautiful. She was elegant. She was she was stunningly educated by today's standards. I mean, you know, not just the standards of medieval Europe, but standards of time. Did I mention she was fabulously rich? Eleanor of Aquitaine. What the hell is Aquitaine? Aquitaine is about a third of what's now France. France didn't really exist in the modern sense of the term. France actually in the 12th century was a fairly piddly small chunk of land. Aquitaine was a lot bigger. So she's beautiful, she's intelligent, she's witty, she's graceful, and she's stunningly rich. A lot of good things going for her. Henry falls madly in love. They get married. Unfortunately, Henry just can't keep it in his pants. He's also stunningly unfaithful. It's good to be king, right? I mean, you know, the king comes into town, lock up your daughters. I mean, basically, if it was wearing a skirt, he'd be going after it. Henry and Eleanor have 5 sons and 3 daughters. The sons include Richard the Lionhearted, Richard I, eventually shot in the neck by an arrow when on crusade, John the I, evil Prince John from Robin Hood fame. Richard was actually a crappy king, despite, you know, the great promo on this. He was a horrible, horrible king. He actually hated England. Actually, pretty much all of them hated England, because they didn't actually speak English. The Normans invaded England in 1066, less than a century earlier. So really, the individuals that were ruling England were really basically what we now think of as French. And so England was cold and damp, and Aquitaine was sunny and bright and warm, and we grow grapes for wine. It was a nice place. So they really all would rather have been over on the continent anyways. Richard was an atrocious king. He was terrible. He's probably gay. There's evidence that he may have been gay, which probably made things complicated. But he really just wanted to go off and fight in the Crusades. He just really wanted to go smack people with a sword. He was relatively good at it, but he kept getting himself captured, and then England would have to pay ransom to get him back. In John's, to John's credit, you know, his younger brother, John never said, you captured the silly blighter? Yeah, you know what? You just keep him. But if you don't give him back, we're going to kill him. You know, if you don't give us the ransom, it's like, yeah, John could have just said, yeah, it's okay, go ahead, you know, kill him. Instead, he kept raising the ransom. So, you know, evil Prince John, in this respect, was kin-selected altruism, right? It's his brother, okay? Anyways, kept raising money. So the taxes were high, and that's how you get the whole Robin Hood thing about, you know, oppressive Prince John. Well, if King Richard didn't keep getting himself captured on crusade, and then he paid off, Okay, so, anyways, these are some of the sons. There's 3 others which are of limited significance to this story. The daughters are completely insignificant to the story. I mentioned that Henry was having sex with all kinds of women. Produced a lot of illegitimate children. Now, at some point in the early 1170s, 1172, Henry starts, for whatever reason, worrying about this. And he starts thinking that he should at least recognize some of these illegitimate children, set them up in, like, duchies and things like that, give them titles, and give them money. Essentially divide up the English royal purse between his sons with Eleanor and his illegitimate children. Eleanor doesn't think this is a particularly good idea, and her sons, at least the 3 eldest, who are 14 and up, don't think this is a great idea, because any monies that's going to these illegitimate kids is not going to go to them. And so there's a rebellion, essentially a civil war. Eleanor and her sons side together. They eventually lose. The battle's not fought primarily actually in England. It's primarily fought actually in Aquitaine in France. But they lose. Eleanor gets imprisoned until 1189, in fact, until actually once Henry dies. Then she heads off and sets up a court of what's called the Court of Romantic Love. So by poets and scientists and all kinds of things. Smart lady. But the point of this was that who does she side with? Her husband? No. She's put up with his infidelities for years. Why? Because her children, one of her sons, is going to be king of England and Aquitaine. This will all go to her children. But as soon as Henry starts talking about giving parcels of the joint kingdoms off to his illegitimate children, it's at this point that she's not so willing to put up with the infidelities. And her sons certainly aren't. Now, they lose the rebellion, as said. Eleanor gets imprisoned. Does Henry kill his sons? No, he actually doesn't. Because he kind of needs them. Right? He knows they're his sons. He's pretty sure his illegitimate kids are his sons as well, but you never quite know on that one. But he knows these are his sons. One of them's going to inherit the king of being king of England and Aquitaine, so he doesn't want them executed. He kind of docks the royal, you know, allowances for a while and gives them some crap jobs of besieging castles and whatnot, but they work it out. Okay. Why don't you take 10? Come on back, and we'll continue.